Stephen Stills is considered the musical heart of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. A virtuoso at a variety of instruments, he was named by Rolling Stone as one of the greatest guitarists of all time. He is also a member of the Songwriters Hall of Fame, penning such iconic tunes as For What It's Worth, while part of Buffalo Springfield. Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, about his then-girlfriend, folk singer Judy Collins, and Love the One You're With, just to name a few. But the life of Stephen Stills has not been just about accolades. It's had its share of low notes as well.
The end of my enjoyment of my success happened on December 8th, 1980. And I believe I poured myself into a bottle of whiskey for about 10 years and pretty much missed the 80s. The trauma of John Lennon being shot in such a ridiculous fashion just took a great deal of the pleasure out of it for me. And now the whole nation is armed. I think I'm well within a certain sense of tranquility to keep to myself. There are those that really crave the spotlight, other than just singing and playing. I like right. the stage, but the spotlight following them around and all this thing of this modern age it drives me to distraction, I must say.
Well, and it's well known that you seldom do interviews and you don't particularly like to do interviews.
No, I can get downright rude. Particularly when the questions are so banal that it's just like, why are we talking about this? Sex, drugs, rock and roll, it's such a cliche,
Well, what question do you think should be asked that doesn't get asked very often, if at all?
What motivates you? Do you sense or do you think about overly the impact on society that these might have? Do you understand the difference between a clever tune and sloganeering? And I'd say we'd cross that line a few times, but I don't want to be a propagandist. That's why For What It's Worth is so enigmatic. It doesn't really come down on either side. It's about being mistreated by the police at home, and it also was a little message and a shout out to the boys over in the NOM who were trying to just get through the day. There's a
man with a gun over For What It's Worth doesn't even use its title phrase in the lyrics. The song is much more easily recognized by its catchy hook. Stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Written by Stills while part of the short-lived rock group Buffalo Springfield, the song became an anthem of the 1960s. And was quickly adopted as a protest song in the struggle for civil rights. What inspired you to write then?
I came up over a hill in Los Angeles and went down Laurel Canyon, and they were having a funeral for a bar. Now this place had been just a little bungalow in the middle of a sort of triangular block, but it of course spilled over into the thoroughfare. And that under L.A., Los Angeles City ordinance is a public nuisance, you're obstructing a public thoroughfare.
I want to get the picture here. This was a big party, if you will.
Yeah,
it wasn't a protest movement.
It was a funeral for a bar. Now, being from New Orleans, that's a very natural event. If there's a favorite watering hole and it's about to close down, then everybody comes to say goodbye to it.
And that's what this was, but it was overflowing.
It was called Pandora's Box. And it was a little place that would have live music. It used to be a house.
So the funeral for the bar was spilling into the streets.
So the cops show up in battalion force.
And that's what prompted the writing of For What It's Worth.
Yeah, and although the first line, there's a man with a gun over there telling me I've got to beware, is both those policemen and it's the VC over when you're on patrol in Rice Paddy.
Now, did you write this down in a notebook or a piece of paper, or are you just keep it in your head?
I've been fiddling with this thing, this line, for several days, and I looked at this, and first thing is, my sense of security said, turn the car around and go the other way, and, you know, because that's more trouble than we want any part of. And the other reason for saying turn the car around is I wanted to get to a guitar right then because the thing was there. And it took me no longer to write it than it took me to actually write the sentences on the paper. It was writing itself on the way home.
Well, it's no secret that you suffer hearing loss. Millions of people in this country, including myself, have hearing loss at one stage or another. And I think it might be inspirational for those of us who do suffer hearing loss to hear you talk about it a bit.
Well, the first thing I would say is that contrary to popular or convenient logic, that standing in front of that big old lamp fire is what done it. But actually, I remember at least half of my relatives were, you know, from both sides of the pen, there was hearing loss and congenital hearing loss and damage in within the family.
Oh, so you don't buy the idea that it's entirely because of rock and roll and listening to such music.
My hearing deficiency was discovered by here socialized medicine for Huey P. Long, when he's governor living in it. He got himself a trailer and he put a doctor's office in it, and he sent it to every elementary school in the state of Louisiana, every parish. Right. And it happened by mine when I was 9 years old, and they said, you have a hearing loss and it's going to get worse. It's right in the speaking range.
When you were 9 years old?
Yeah. So I am now, I am at the it's going to get worse part. As a matter of fact, well past the it's going to get, I'm profoundly deaf in this ear, and I've got about a 30% loss on this side.
Now, do you or do you not worry that that may affect your ability to sing? After all, your voice depends greatly on your ears.
Well, only if you're working with bat ears, which is what I call David Crosby, because he will notice if I slip even a millimeter out of tune. Of course, I will too when I hear the recording later, but it doesn't appear to me now, and I've got this nice vibrato that I cover it up with. But what's really irritating to me now is that it's gotten so bad that I've got to be in a pretty close reflective room to be able to hear my acoustic guitar. But the other thing is that this is not specific to musicians. This is a nationwide thing because of just the noise of life in America, cars and trucks and sirens and horns honking and trains and just, you know, all the whistles and bells of modern day life. There is a general hearing loss that's becoming more and more pronounced. And the equipment that they're building to address this malady is, I would call it barbaric in its simplicity. It's just a little bitty microphone with a couple of amplifiers in it, and it's woefully inadequate to the job because the human body can hear from anywhere from 25,000 cycles up where dogs can hear all the way down to about 60, but the frequencies, they actually harmonize with each other in order to produce a whole experience that's neurological and physiological and also spiritual. That's what music does.
Indeed. Well, you've written so many songs and great songs, but
I've written good songs. I've written some albatrosses, those things that just follow you around. And about the 1,000th performance, you realize how absurd it is. If you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. You want to slap yourself.
And if you can't be with the one you love, honey, love the one you're with. And you got something to love the one you're with.
Stills picked up the phrase from fellow musician Billy Preston, who gave his blessing for Stills to use it. Love the One You're With was the most successful of Stills' solo career and has become part of the Crosby, Stills, and Nash repertoire. I want to ask you about your colleagues of so long. At bass, who is David Crosby?
He is one of the most wonderful and just delightfully surreal people that I've met in my life, and wonderfully articulate. And only since I've lost my hearing and he grew that mustache and it's gotten all white, I can't understand half of what he says. And he's very soft-spoken. He's provided me with endless hours of, I mean, fall on the floor, belly laughs.
And how about your friend Graham Nash? Who is he?
I do not consider myself, you know, qualified to define, but I would say that I learned an awful lot about craftsmanship and about attentiveness and about passion and about tenacity from him. And he's just a lovely, generous, wonderful, beautiful guy. What a blessing, both of them.
What a blessing indeed. We're near the end here. What question have I not asked you that I should have asked you?
I can't think of a thing. I think you've done a marvelous job of discerning what we're about, because it's not so much that we're going to change the world, it's we want to convince everybody that it's possible. And we're about the joy of making a wonderful noise together.
The third voice in Crosby, Stills, and Nash is that of Graham Nash, whose path to American rock and roll stardom began in a small town in England. Well, tell me, how does a British young man become part of a group that's so synonymous with American culture?
American rock and roll music. When I first heard Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers and Elvis and Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis, my life was over. I knew what I wanted to do. The Beatles were successful, of course, and they opened up giant, enormous doors that every single band wanted to run through. You know, when they first had their hit record and conquered America, that's what we wanted to do.
Well, the Hollies were a tremendously successful British band. What was it like when you first played in the U.S.?
We thought that we were going to do our 45 minutes of dynamite. You know, we got to the Paramount in Times Square in New York City in Easter of 1965 on the Soupy Sales Easter show. And the stage manager says, okay, what two songs are you doing? Two songs? We came all this way to do two songs? Yeah, but it's six times a day. And there's 12 other people on the same act, you know. So it was very strange. We had to let go. We thought we knew what we were doing in our English way, but when we came to America, we had to let go. I don't know whether you remember, in Times Square, there was that camel high up that blew smoke rings. Right. That was fantastic to a kid from Manchester. I'd never seen anything like that in my life, right? A real hamburger? People that would deliver food to you? This was paradise. Oh, yeah. No, I knew where I wanted to be the moment I set foot in America. I climbed up the nearest palm tree when I went to Los Angeles, and I told Alan Clark I was never going back.
Alan Clark and Graham Nash were longtime childhood friends when they started the Hollies. Named after Buddy Holly, the group had a long string of hits on both sides of the Atlantic, including the 1966 single, Bus Stop. But eventually, Nash was ready to sing a different tune. Well, why did you leave?
The music. I had heard me and David and Steven sing. It was completely a unique sound to me. We, you know, the Byrds and the Buffalo Springfield and the Hollies were very decent harmony bands. But this was something different. When David and Steven and I put our voices and blended them together before they hit the microphone, we knew that it was something very, very unique and very different. So it's the power of that vocal blend that we got to within 40 seconds of singing with each other. 40 seconds.
Incredible, is that? Quick.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody sounds like us when we're on it. Nobody in the world.
Well, in your autobiography, you said, the unique sound that we make is like the pull of gravity to the center of the earth.
Yes. That's how important music is to me. I think music is incredibly important in people's lives. That's why it saddens me that, you know, many school budgets, the first thing that they cut is the music program. You know, when it's proven that kids learn more, get into less trouble, get into fewer gangs, you know, stay in school longer, if there's music in the schools.
You're absolutely convinced that music is an essential element of education.
And of communication between people, yes. Somebody asked me a question last night. I was doing a book signing, and somebody said, would you have made more music, or would you have made better music had you been straight all these years? Obviously, in my autobiography, I go into great detail about our drug use, because there's no denying what happened. You know, we were high for most of our lives at that point. And so there's no real answer to that question, because we'll never know.
When did drug use start? Did you start with marijuana?
Yes. Yes.
And about when did that start?
For me, mid-68, when I first came to Laurel Canyon. And we had a dear friend, Cass Elliott, who was the singer with the Mamas and Papas. Yeah. And she was the woman that changed my life completely. She was the one that introduced me to Crosby, who would then, of course, introduce me to Stills, and then, of course, Neil. Cass Elliott was a very interesting person in rock and roll. She was very much like Gertrude Stein. She would gather people together from different disciplines to talk about what's going on in their lives, how can we make this better. She was a real firecracker, Cass. And had I not met her, my entire life would have been completely different.
So you say, you think mid-68 is yes. when you started smoking dope.
You're right.
And that led to harder stuff?
It led to cocaine. I've never tried heroin. I don't ever want to. It doesn't make sense to me that you would be able to take a drug that could kill you instantly. I never thought that we would die smoking dope. I never thought that we would die snorting cocaine, actually. One of the most disturbing parts of putting my life down in the book was how people would perceive Crosby. The only time I ever got a call from the legal department of the publishing was of a story I told about David, who actually sold his Mercedes for cocaine, and the dealer died, and David stole into the house while the dealer was still dead and stole his pink slip bat for the Mercedes and then resold the car for more cocaine.
Well, I can imagine that the book publisher's lawyers would be all
yes,
over that.
They were all over that. But I told Crosby, and I said, this is what I'm saying because that's what you told me happened. And he said, don't change a word. He admitted it. He was a man about, you know, his drug use.
I'm thinking about how few people would have taken that attitude. It tells you a lot about David Crosby.
It tells you a lot about David, yeah. David Crosby is one of the most unique people I know, and I know a lot of people. He's an unbelievably unique, rare musician. He's very jazz influenced. Strange chords, strange tunings, things I personally, would, as a writer, would never think of, you know. He's a very smart man, David Crosby. And at a point in my life when I was leaving the Hollies and they were allowing me to doubt myself as an artist, that maybe I'm not as good as I think I am, or I don't know what I'm doing, or, you know, that kind of strange thing that keeps you awake at night. When I was going through that with the Hollies, it was Crosby that was saying, no. No, that Marrakesh Express? No, that's a good song. No, come on, come over here, come on, let's go. You know, so he gave back my faith in myself, and that's invaluable. What is the price of that?
Stephen Stills, who is he?
Stephen Stills is a leader. Stephen Stills is a tremendous, tremendous musician, a great arranger, stubborn, won't quit until he thinks it's right.
Well, that brings us to the question, who and what are you?
There's a part of me that is still waiting to get found out. I'm 71 years old now. I've been doing this successfully a long time. But there's a part of my soul that doesn't quite believe that I should be here. You know, I'm this poor kid from the north of England who had the wisdom to follow his parents' advice about following his heart in my passion for music. Who am I? I want to get the job done. If we're going to commit to doing a tour, or commit to doing an album, or commit to singing a note, I want to get the job done the best way we can. I personally think that time and our family are all we have. When my father died at 46 and the clouds didn't stop scurrying across the sky and the birds didn't stop singing, and I realized, my God, you have to fill your life with the best you can for every second of your life. I'll never make it 100%, but I'm certainly trying to have the best life I can, because why not?
Well, why not? I like the question.
Yeah.
You've written some very memorable songs. We won't go through the whole list, but Our House, Teach Your Children, Chicago, Wasted on the Way. What are some of the stories behind these songs?
There's a story behind every single one of them. And what I like to do is celebrate the ordinary moments in life. And I'll give you an example. I took Joni Mitchell to breakfast once in Los Angeles. We left the restaurant. We pass an antique store. She looks in the window. She sees a beautiful vase in the window that she wants to buy. Now, I mean, I know I haven't been with Joan for, you know, over 40 years, but she probably still has her first dollar. She doesn't spend a lot of money on herself, but she did buy this vase. And so we went back to her house in Laurel Canyon, where we were living, and I said, you know something? I'll light a fire. Why don't you put some flowers in that vase that you just... And all of a sudden...
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today.
That incredibly ordinary moment that you and I as men have experienced a thousand times. You know, okay, love, you do that and I'll do this and then tea will happen, you know, dinner will happen and the kids will be fine. You know, that's a perfect example. Because when Joni was in the garden trying to find flowers for the vase, she wasn't at her piano, which means I was. And Our House was written incredibly quickly.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard.
What an interesting concept about writing. You say you like to write about the ordinary moment.
My life is made up of ordinary moments.
Well, most everybody's life is.
Indeed.
And that's the point. But as I listen to you, I'm reminded, and you're very much aware of this, that there are a number of people who say, listen, I love Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They're great musicians. I love it. But I hate it when they start talking, quote, politics. How do you feel about that?
I can't separate my music from my politics. And I'm not so sure that politics is the right title. When you shoot four kids down at Kent Strait because of their constitutional right to protest what their government is doing in their name, and you kill them, is that politics or is that humanity?
The guardsmen have fired 61 shots. Four students are dead.
Neil Young wrote the powerful Ohio in 1970 after seeing the iconic photographs of Vietnam War protesters shot dead by National Guardsmen on the Kent State campus. The song captured the mood of a divided nation and quickly became a sharp rallying cry against the war. Is that on your list of most important songs you've been associated with or not?
Yes, very much so. It was such a wound in the national soul. We're killing our own children. Something's terribly wrong here. We had a single of Teach Your Children going up the charts. Right. It was in the top 20, going to the top five. We killed our own single because we thought that Ohio was more important to talk about than having a hit single.
What question have I not asked you I should have asked you?
How am I feeling?
Well, how are you feeling?
Fantastic.
Please be gone, I'm tired of you. What have you got to lose?
Few bands have been launched with the fanfare of Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Thank you.
Woodstock was their coming out party. They even recorded a song, penned by Joni Mitchell, about the famed music festival.
We are stars.
For many, it became the definitive song of a legendary weekend. As I was preparing for this interview and talking to someone, this was a person roughly my age. Keep in mind, I'm now 82 years old. I said, I'm going out to talk to Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He said, oh, those hippie guys. Well, now, going back to the beginning, were you hippies?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
Yeah.
We were.
I'll admit it, absolutely. But, you know, those hippie ideals, you know, the so-called hippie ideals still remain true to this day, that love is better than hatred. That peace is better than war. That maybe we should take care of each other like be our brother's keeper. maybe we should take care of our environment. You know, those hippie ideals are still incredibly important today. So I'll admit to being a hippie, and I still am.
I think we started out even before that with, you know, Kerouac and the Beats, that generation of thinking influenced us and I think gave birth to the hippies.
Did you read Jack Kerouac?
Oh, yeah.
Did you read him, Stephen?
Yeah, I read him when I was in the French Quarter.
He and Allen Ginsberg.
Bohemian is pretty much the way I describe it. The hippies are an extension of the Bohemians.
Well, I'm a journalist, obviously, and I'm always interested in getting this story straight. Can we settle on how Crosby, Stills, and Nash started?
No.
There's no agreement?
No.
Well, let's start
this way.
Let's start with you. What's your version of how it all started?
Okay. You know how the mind memory works, and there are some events that impact you so extremely that you have a cinematographic, smellophonic, you know, absolutely high definition picture memory. And I remember looking past Cass Elliot and this guy. He was standing over here. Cass was standing at her door,
Graham.
Looking past at him, and said, "Oh my God, it's Graham Nash from the other night." And that's the day that I think that we first sang at her dining room table.
Now, Graham, does that match your memory?
Absolutely not.
No.
Well, what's your version of this story?
My version is that I came from London to visit Joni in Los Angeles.
Joni Mitchell.
Went to her house. David and Stephen were there at dinner. That's when we first sang together. And Stephen is correct in that it was such an incredibly profound musical moment in all of our lives that we will never forget the first time. But on my autobiography that we were talking about earlier, the last sentence is, "This is how I remember it." Because we all have our truths. Obviously, Stephen and David and I completely disagree about when we first sang together. But that's the fragility of the human spirit. We all have our own truths.
So, David, now what's your version of where it all came together?
What he said.
You agree with Graham?
Yeah. Oh, there's no question about it. I remember it distinctly.
Well, there is some question because Stephen has different memories.
I absolutely remember this as vividly as with this moment that we're sitting here, as vividly as where I was when Jack Kennedy was killed, because that's how special the music was. It was a rosewood dining table in Cass Elliot's kitchen, and there 2 days later we went to Joni's, where she lived in a lovely little bungalow on Wonderland Avenue, and we sang around her table with ladder back chairs.
Well,
so I remember both instances. I just did this, you know, like
I'll
I said.
I'll give you an example of his memory. He thinks it was Wonderland. It was Lookout Mountain Drive. So.
Well, in my story, I guess what I'm going to have to say is there are differences of opinion.
Yes.
As to when and how the first meeting happened.
But we all knew that it was good, and that's the main thing.
That is the main thing. So let's concentrate on that for the moment. For the moment, set aside where it happened, whether it happened in
right.
Mama Cass's place or Joni Mitchell's place. What happened, Stephen?
He says he did, but I said, Cass said, "Why don't you and David sing those things that you've been working on?" So we went to the table, and I picked a corner so that I could really hear the two of them. David sat on this side, and the other side, he roamed around and listened to us sing this very simple song that has one verse twice, three times.
And the song was?
"In the Morning When You Rise."
In the morning when you rise.
The official title of the song was "You Don't Have to Cry." The lush harmony became the signature sound for their landmark debut album.
It was a startling moment. Graham, we sang it to him. He said, "Would you do that again?" And we looked at each other and thought, "Well, okay." So we sang it again. He said,
one more time.
And we sang it, and he put the top part on, and that was, I knew at that moment what I was going to be doing with my life for quite some time.
In the morning.
It was like a horse with three heads and galloping on the four legs of my finger picking.
Did you know at that moment
what you were going to be doing the rest of your life.
I know that I'd never heard a vocal group sound like that ever. I mean, the Celtic keen of his voice, his cat's purr, and my cement truck or whatever it is, just had this blesh that
That's blend and mesh.
That was, we could do anything.
It was absolutely, completely a unique sound. It was one voice made up of three individual strains of voice. There was no doubt. We knew what we had. We were in love with each other.
That's true.
In love with the music. We were in love with each other's songs. We couldn't wait to get out there. Get out of our way. We're coming forward.